The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com. Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, January 9, 2019, and this is the Bob Seska Show, interviews from Earth One. My guest today is one of my favorite people ever, the great Steven Weber. You probably know Steven from his legendary roles as Brian Hackett on Wings, Jack Torrance in The Shining, Jack Rudolph on the Die Too Young Sorkin series, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, countless other roles on stage, screen, and even in animated GIF form. We'll talk about that today, too. Steven also runs one of the most hilariously warped Twitter feeds anywhere, and if you're not following The Steven Weber on Twitter, you're missing out. Meanwhile, if you like what you hear, please consider supporting the show at patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. And now my chat with the incomparable Steven Weber. You know, it's amazing. We've actually known each other as e-friends for exactly 10 years now. How about that?
Wow. That's amazing.
In fact,
now, where are you living? Are you in Hawaii still?
No.
I
was in Hawaii for 5 years, and then I moved to Northern California, and now I'm in Washington, D.C., where I grew up. So,
it's, wow, how about that?
Yeah, kind of a full circle thing. But, you know, this is the first time we've ever actually talked over the phone. And by the way, we're underway now, so this is all recorded.
I mean, it's happening?
Yeah, it's happening. You know, I was watching one of your other interviews the other day, and one of the comments underneath read simply, "I feel like my pussy was eaten tonight." And I'm not making that up. That's an actual comment under one of your interviews. And so no pressure to top it during today's interview, Stephen.
Who was he?
It was amazingly, I didn't mean to go toward politics, but it was the president. The president said that.
I knew it.
Of course. He's a potty mouth.
He's probably talking about Jared.
You know,
yeah, well, it's inescapable, isn't it? I mean, yeah. It's something that everybody is wearing and the expression is on their face.
Right.
And, I even bring it into my shrink, who agrees there's like this is existential load being born on the, collective backs. I mean, of the majority of the people and even the people who support this guy,
yeah.
I have to believe are like, it's like Stockholm syndrome or something. They don't know any better. It's tribal. It's basic. It's so strange.
I've been calling it a crisis, and you know what? I promised you that we weren't going to talk about politics, and here we are right out of the gate.
We can.
I mean, but it's a political crisis. It's a national security crisis. But I think you're right. I think there's a psychological crisis is going on too, where the president, and this is just a general observation, really doesn't have anything to do with Trump necessarily, but the president shouldn't be in our faces this often. We shouldn't have to hear from the president of the United States 24/7, where he's constantly tapping us on the shoulder and says, "Oh, by the way, I'm still here. Oh, and here's some awfulness that you have to digest, America." And it's so much fun.
It's so not about politics or anything. It's about the psychology of this particular person, his acolytes, and by extension, the nation. I tend to anthropomorphizes, if that's the word, the country.
Yeah.
And I always look at America as somebody that started off really well, had great instinct and fought and suffered and got, and went into business and did well. And then, like so many people, got drunk on success, got addicted to opiates, and is now out of control and failing. And, it's obviously a simplistic kind of a metaphor, but he's the embodiment of that, it seems to me. I guess I feel that there is always hope for recovery, and there is. I mean, the signs are there. But he's the thing that he embodies is also it's virulent, and again, even though we decided not to talk about politics, kind of can't help it. It to me, and I'm an unlettered guy. I have no real deep education when I say this, but to me, it's the triumph of capitalism in a way. You know, where we are now. I mean, capitalism on its own is such a kind of soulless transactional philosophy.
Yeah.
And that's why it definitely worked when there were those so-called socialist components, you know, like beating money back into the economy and, you know, vis-a-vis taxes and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And programs to help the disenfranchised and the unfortunate. That helps. You will still get rich. Maybe not as rich if you cut out every regulation and killed everybody in your path, but it's a short-sighted approach.
Well, you're so right. I mean, capitalism is one of those systems in which it requires the exploitation of the populace in order to actually prosper and flourish. So,
right.
And likewise with what we saw in the 2016 election, where I think so many people were fished in by not just this guy's campaign style, but also by the Russian propaganda that was flooding social media that we all saw at the time and only are now realizing, oh, that's what it was. And so the thing that is constantly disillusioning to me, and I don't know about you, but I see that as indicative of being an American society that is almost grotesquely naive in what we accept as the truth and how we were taken for suckers. Not necessarily by Donald Trump, but by Fox News Channel, by Russian propaganda, and all points in between. And obviously, social media is a big part of that, which then, of course, leads us into to Twitter and one of the areas that we both enjoy so much. And you know, it's funny with Twitter, Stephen. You have one of the most amazing Twitter feeds I've ever seen. And I want to get into the details of that in a second. But with Twitter, I feel like the entire world makes fun of Twitter until they get on Twitter and then they can't stop being on Twitter. Is that a fair assessment of the dichotomy of how people feel about that that platform?
I think it is a fair assessment, but it also speaks to, what's wrong, I think, with our society, generally speaking, that we've become addicted to, easy affirmation and a kind of a passive participation in our society. You know, these are called social media promotes so much antisocial behavior, and it permits and it's permitted because people don't have to actually physically socialize, i.e., be in each other's physical spaces. There's no a virtual town square, it turns out, is no substitute for a literal town square. You need to be in each other's spaces so you can read the nuance and the subtlety and make an actual connection. The kind of ersatz aspect of social media has increased people's ease in allowing stuff to, in allowing bad shit. I can say shit on your show, right?
Oh yes, of course.
Yeah, I'm gonna say it a lot. Allowing the shit that we were just talked about to happen.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. And on top of all of that, and I'm not sure if you've ever experienced this dynamic, but what social media has also done is made everyone experts in everything, or I should say, armchair experts in everything. And one of the things that you see most often as a consequence of social media are, for example, people explaining science to scientists, for example. And also,
right.
I mean, I don't know. Have you ever had someone explain acting to you over Twitter as if they don't realize?
Well, no. No, they haven't. But, you know, when I was really tweeting a lot, I made the mistake of assuming the very thing that you just pointed to, which I assumed that I knew more than I actually did. And basically what I was doing was regurgitating second, third, fourth, fifth hand information, stuff that other media outlets were, I guess spewing is a pejorative, you know, spewing that appealed to my own sensibilities, and then I would hurl that out there and then engage with other people and have arguments. But I hadn't thoroughly researched anything, you know, and I was in a way just as bad as the things that I was decrying. That's one reason why I gave up for several years, as I realized that I was hooked. I was sucked into the Twitter vortex, which means easy affirmation, easy fights, a total superficial and therefore incredibly attractive relationship to the world. I did not have to really. Oh, hold on! I have a puppy.
What was that? Oh my God!
Yeah, I have a puppy. I just got a puppy, my first puppy, and her name is Cat. Isn't that funny? A puppy named Cat.
Cat.
And she's super sweet, and she's also a Jack Russell. She's a Jack Russell mix.
Okay.
So she doesn't have the kind of Bob Seska, Jack Russell, insane jumping around thing.
That's right.
It's mitigated by, you know, other, I guess, I want to say Eastern European influences.
Right. Very, very intelligent dogs, very busy dogs. You always have to make sure they have something to do. Otherwise, everything's going to get torn up in your house when you least expect it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, all my collection of Edwardian dildos.
That too,
definitely.
Of course, the Jack Russells love the dildos.
In Jeopardy.
See now, Jeopardy. That brings us to one of the things, one of the main things that I think you're known for, strangely enough, which is your Twitter feed, which is kind of like, here's how he described the Steven Weber Twitter feed. It's like, remember Larry King's old column in USA Today, where occasionally he would just do random Larry King thoughts.
Right.
Well, it's right. Basically your Twitter feed is like if Larry King was blitzed on mushrooms. That's
Larry
kind of how
King.
It is. Like, for example,
thank you. I think.
Well, yeah, and that's absolutely 100% a compliment because, of course, taking it to that extra level makes it especially entertaining and just almost like brutally outrageous. Like, I would say half of your tweets I laugh at because they are insanely funny, and the other half I laugh at just because of the nerve of them, where you just don't care. For example, I jotted down a few of them here. So a couple of my favorites recently were you predicting the future. So you say here, in the future, sperm lozenges will be dispensed from the penis like sleeves of Pez. That is genius. Then you followed it up by saying, in the future, toilet paper will be replaced with teensy nano coal miners. See, you're trying to bring back the coal jobs, aren't you?
That's true. That's true. In my way, I'm trying to help the Trump administration.
So,
these are all things that have been, fostered by in their think tanks.
See now.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, if Larry King used more scrotum references, how about that? How about that as a
well,
as a,
you know,
comparison.
Larry King, but Larry King is composed mostly of scrotal tissue. You know, did you know that?
That's,
I mean,
true.
Under those suspenders is like a puckered, chewy skin.
Not to get too much off.
Goodbye, Bob.
Bye, Stephen. We'll see you later. Not to get too much off on a tangent here with regard to Stephen King, but this guy, I find Stephen King. I mean, not Stephen King. We're going to get to Stephen King in a second.
Larry King.
Larry King. I find Larry King endlessly entertaining just because he's so fucking weird and he doesn't seem to understand how weird he is. For example, he wants to be cryogenically frozen. Are you aware of this? Where he doesn't?
No, I didn't.
He wants to be frozen and then revived when they come up with a cure for whatever kills him, so he can live on and on and on, presumably doing more and more interviews into the foreseeable next several millennia, I guess.
It'll be like, well, you know, I'm a big Futurama fan, so I mean, they sort of cornered that market with the heads in the jars. But
right. That's
there was
Larry.
A story years ago that really got me going, especially when I was tweeting more than I do now. I mean, I actually retweet a lot of my old ridiculous tweets.
See, it's, if it's funny
some
once,
of them, yeah.
It's,
I mean, I update them, but some I because it's just too much. You know, I had to stop. I thought, what am I doing? Why am I even doing this? You know, A, I'm not getting paid for it. So what the I'm casting pearls before swine. And then B, it's like not really. And then B, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
Who cares about this? Well, I don't know what it's for. And then that's what I mean. It led me into led me down paths on Twitter that were destructive to me.
Yeah.
You know, engaging. People think that they know you, and I don't know. And then I was making assumptions about them, too. It's just a big pain in the ass. But I did come back, and I like to, you know, write enjoyably ridiculous things sometimes.
Right. And for my personal edification, I mean, because that's if there's one person and that person happens to be me who is reading your tweets, then they're totally worthwhile. I mean,
thank you. I mean, I like the absurd. I do. I have to admit.
Well, I mean, do you sit down and say, okay, now I'm going to tweet, or do you just do these scrotal references? And I mean, do you suddenly just get the thought, I need to tweet about something having to do with a basement piss orgy? That's what I'm going to tweet about today. Or...
Goodbye, Bob. well, I don't know. It's just the thing that it lends itself to is the accessibility of that kind of stream of consciousness stuff. This is stuff that I would say with friends, and they would say back to me. You know, it's like the Algonquin end table, haha. You know, but it it provided a kind of a writer's room, Twitter, and an audience, and those two things are very seductive, I have to say. You know, the audience, it was the immediate affirmation, people laughing and stuff that I found very intoxicating.
Yeah.
The upside is that is I actually met a bunch of cool people. Sarah Silverman, I think, became a friend from Twitter. I can't say hold on because we're doing a show, and I think I got to let my dog out to take a shit.
Well, go ahead. Go for it.
Well,
yeah.
Hold on one second. Here, you can listen to this.
Okay, yeah, great. Here's Stephen Weber letting his dog out to take a shit.
Oh my God! It looks like a king cobra out of this tiny puppy rectum.
Amazing what they can do, right? Just the amount of shit that could come out of a teeny tiny dog always amazes me.
It's amazing. Anyway, what the hell was I saying?
Something about Twitter. We were talking about Twitter, and of course, you know, here's the thing about Twitter right now that I don't know if you've experienced this. Harrowing aspect of it yet, but Twitter, there's a rise of something I like to call Twitter scolds, and I'm sure you've seen them. They're not right-wing trolls or anything like that. What they are is they're like language police, and they go around and they check everyone's Twitter feeds, and then they decide to land on you, and they go through everything you've written for the last 10 years on Twitter, and then they regurgitate it out of context and say, "You're never going to work again, sir."
Right.
And then lives are destroyed. I mean, in some cases, we'll see like someone like Richard Spencer, like some right-wing Nazi lunatic who's saying awful things on Twitter. And in those cases, I can sometimes say, well, I understand the outrage. That completely makes sense.
Yeah.
He's a Nazi after all. In a lot of cases, like with the director James Gunn, for example, he was, I think, unfairly targeted for jokes that he made that were more satirical of those ideas than they were actually repeating those ideas. You know what I mean?
Yes, of course. Look, I think it speaks to, again, ultimately, the shallow, you know, mistermed social media, you know, shallow, but it's very shallow. It's so shallow, and it doesn't require any effort. It's funny because that's what technology sort of aspired to: make things easier.
Yep.
You know, have your meals in a pill, have moving sidewalks. In other words, you know, do less and less. Why? To free up people so they can have more leisure time.
Right.
I think that's turning into a bullshit theory because people need to be involved. They need to use the apparatus that they were given or born with to interact, and that's how they learn. You know, everything becomes so passive, and there's so much distance between the thought and the act that people feel entitled to say anything. There's no consequence to.
Yeah.
Well, haven't people done those experiments where they confront their trolls or and the trolls turn out to be not nearly as ferocious as they are on a Twitter feed? They're actually people with subtle and not so subtle complexities And then you begin to learn about each other and forgive each other and all that stuff. That's almost been obliterated completely from, you know, from ads and from our media. I can go on and on and on. And
yeah.
It's almost like I'm high, but I'm not. I'm high on you, Bob.
And as
you're,
always,
you're
as
like
you
an edible.
Be. Right,
you're
right.
Like big edible.
Yeah, actually,
I'm just,
you know,
like blabbing now.
Kevin Smith did a thing in one of his movies where two of his characters went around door to door and beat up everyone who said something bad about them in the discussion forums. I thought that was very cathartic. I think maybe we revisit that for Twitter or something. Maybe you and me, Stephen, travel the country and beat up anyone that trolls us on Twitter. How about that?
Yeah, that'll be great. That'll be great. I can't wait. I can't wait.
It'll be a great expenditure of time, won't it? Time well spent.
Oh, yeah, and we'll be looking at the wall from the Mexico side, you and me. Let me tell you.
All right.
Gone.
I want to talk. Let's step away from Twitter here for a second. Let's talk about your meat and potatoes here, which is, of course, scrotum references. No, I mean acting, of course. And
thanks.
Right now, you're performing with the great Alfred Molina, right? In A Walk in the Woods.
I'm about to do it for LA Theater Works, which is a great organization out here in Los Angeles, and they have recorded for over the years many plays for posterity, radio, and they're performed in front of live audiences. And Alfred Molina and I are doing the play, the Lee Blessing play, A Walk in the Woods, which has a bunch of it's very pertinent to what's going on. It's about a Russian and an American diplomat who are, they're having negotiations.
Nice.
And it's obviously very talky.
Yeah.
And all that. But it's great just to be able to work with Alfred Molina, who's one of the most fantastic actors, you know, in the 20th and 21st centuries. So versatile and he's a great guy.
Yeah, and I've heard that. And, you know, it's fascinating because one of my all-time favorite scenes ever committed to film was his scene in Boogie Nights, that entire sequence where they sort of recreate the Wonderland murders.
And
in fact,
there's
literally, yeah, exactly. The guy in the background with the firecrackers is just one of the most incredible scenes, one of the most intense scenes I've ever seen in film.
Yeah.
But there's only one actor I could see in that Alfred Molina role, and that's actually you, because I think you both have that intense level of insanities just lurking right behind your eyeballs. And I think I would love to see that scene interpreted by you with the mustache and the robe and the crack cocaine and all of it. That'd be fantastic. Just doing it for me. I'll just sit on the couch and you can act it out.
All right. We can work that out.
Now, is this project your whole life right now, A Walk in the Woods, or are you a good multitasker with a bunch of different projects at the same time? How's it
well,
work?
Well, I mean, I'm a pretty good multitasker. I'm doing because the process of rehearsal and recording is only comprises about 2 weeks, really. You can stay on book because, again, you're doing it for radio, ostensibly.
Yeah. Interesting.
But while I'm doing that, I'm also working on the show 13 Reasons Why. I'm doing episodes of Ballers. I have a couple more coming up. So I've been really kind of a journeyman actor for the last several years. Like a lot of actors, we're looking for that mythical show that runs for 5-6 years. Nobody knows it's on the air, and you make untold money, and you know. And at this point, I would do Real Housewives of Isis. My joke, you know, because I've been doing it so long, and I just want a modicum of regularity when it comes to income. You know, that's the one thing that really doesn't change for 99% of the people in my field, which is you're always having to sing for your supper, even, you know, well into your older years.
Yeah.
It's so funny that people have the idea, and this happens on Twitter a lot, you know, just go back to being an actor, or you have I tweeted something a couple of weeks ago. I said basically a stupid pun. It's a pun, a play on war is not the answer. I wrote, wall is not the answer.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's slightly political and it's a slight play on John Lennon's War's Not the Answer. Well, I was so attacked by people that I was like, what the fuck? You got to be kidding me. And the majority of the comments had to do with me being an actor, me having a big wall around my mansion, okay? You know, the vast majority of actors are middle class, you know, lower middle class kind of working stiffs. Guess what? You know, and instead of, you know, unclogging a toilet, they're trying to create beautiful things and make a living at the same time. And that's it. You know, that's the majority. And the top 1% of the top 1% are the people, the Tom Cruises, et cetera. And everybody else extrapolates that that's the entire business. Every actor is, you know, living high on the hog. I assure you, we're not.
Yeah, it seems, and especially now, but I mean, just one last thing about that, array of trolls who attack you after that tweet. You know, it's amazing that the shut up and act line is still a thing, given that the president is the 12-year host of Celebrity Apprentice. It just seems like that attack has lost its efficacy anymore. It's just strange that people still use it.
I agree.
But I mean,
you know, it's just so easy to just base full ideologies on shallow knee-jerk responses.
Yeah.
And that's an example of it.
Well, you know, and the thing about your career and just looking over your resume, I think people would be actually shocked. People who don't really follow you specifically would be shocked at really how much you work. And it's not just... it's not just work. It's not just a bunch of guest appearances on TV shows. You're doing stage. You're doing film. You're doing TV. You're doing voice work. I mean, it seems like there's quite a bit of voice work in there for animated projects and so on. Do you have a favorite? I know it's hard to pick a favorite child, but do you have a favorite arena to work in?
I guess I really do prefer working in theater. It's the best expression of what I trained to do. I feel like it's the best expression of, you know, my chosen profession, acting. For me personally, it's the most fulfilling. It actually requires the most effort, which is good for me. You know, I'm not good with idle time. And when you're doing a play and working on it, you have no idle time. I mean, and also there's that other aspect, which I used to be kind of not ashamed to talk about, but a little embarrassed to talk about, which is the artistic component.
You know,
something happens when you're on stage, and once in a while, there's a convergence of the material and the performance and the audience, and it's kind of wonderful. It's not kind of wonderful; it absolutely is, and it's something I think artists of all stripes feel that there's it suddenly matters. It suddenly goes from just being a job to something more than that. People are moved, people are helped, and that helps and moves you. And then the relationship is formed. Well, I'm gonna cry.
No, and well, it's true. It's all absolutely true.
Yeah, I mean, theater's the thing. But look, they're all fun. It's all of a piece. I mean, I feel so lucky. I'm so grateful to be working in, again, my chosen field.
It
ain't easy all the time. But
when did you discover you could perform and actually be entertaining at that? That you actually not just here's something I'd like to do, but oh my God, I'm actually kind of good at this, and this feels good. I feel like I can really make my way through here. At what point in time did that come about, or was there like an epiphany where suddenly it happened, or did you kind of develop it over time?
Well, my first kind of seminal moments were, I think, in the third grade, where we did a play version of Where the Wild Things Are, and I found myself playing the character of the dragon, which I believe is only on two pages. Mm-hmm. But I ad-libbed profusely and got laughs, and that's when it was like the first shot of heroin that you and I did that time we were on...
The Black Tar. I remember that.
Oh, the Black Tar... delicious.
Yes.
And it was that first shot that really got me hooked, and I guess it began to appeal to me, And from then on, I began to pursue that type of, again, affirmation. It was probably more of a psychological and emotional reward I was getting.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the first moment. After that, I began to go out for plays and in school, and even did commercials when I was a little kid. And I suppose I had some sort of facility.
Yeah. What were some of the commercials that you did as a kid?
Well, this was in the era of the, you know, the 60-second commercial. I had a log cabin syrup commercial that, compared to what we experience now in media, went on. It was like the Lawrence of Arabia of commercials, probably 45 seconds long, with endless cuts and at breakfast table. And then I did one for GAF Talking Viewmaster, which was, I don't even know if people even remember what those were.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know, they're the disc pictures that you you pop into a viewer and you put it up to your face.
Yeah, today they call that VR, right? It's like the early VR, right?
Yeah, it's the earliest. Mm. It was just one step past, you know, painting.
That's right.
And I did a couple of those, and then basically I years passed, and I went to the High School of Performing Arts, known for being the FAME school.
Oh.
And this was in the 70s, and started taking things seriously.
And of course, your parents had to be supportive because they were performers too, right?
Well, they weren't performers. It's funny. I don't know where this got messed up in various biographies or biographical data, but my mom was a nightclub singer, mm-hmm. when she was very young in New York City in the 50s, and worked at the Copacabana and a lot of clubs. And then my father was an agent of comedians and singers in the Borscht Belt and Atlantic City and clubs in New York City. And his father was a fellow named Willie Weber. And Willie Weber was an early manager of Jackie Gleason and the early manager of Don Rickles.
Oh, my God.
That was the atmosphere that I grew up in. They neither encouraged nor discouraged me, to be perfectly honest. It just seemed to be coming my way, and nobody said boo about it. I guess it kept me off the streets until much later.
So it's like Pat Cooper's hanging out at your house a lot. Was it like your house like this cavalcade of like vaudevillians and Catskills guys in and out?
Well, literally, Pat Cooper was managed by my father and grandfather, so I did know him.
Oh, wow. Okay. I had no idea.
Yeah, that was a good one. But it was almost like Broadway Danny Rose, not nearly as low rent, but perilously close. I mean, that's an aspect of show business, especially comedy and the nightclub world, that really still exists. There's a seediness to it. And again, a reality that is subverted by people's perceptions of their stars, much like the way Twitter subverts, you know, the reality of what it means to really kind of interact. I'm going off on a tangent, but I went backstage to several shows and concerts, Sinatra concerts. My dad had a comedian who opened up for Sinatra for 10 years, whose name was Pat Henry, who's virtually forgotten today, mm-hmm. but he had done the shows, you know, Ed Sullivan and all those variety shows that were on TV, and he was fairly well known. And so as a kid, I was backstage. I never met the great man himself, but my dad was a friend of his, and had plenty of photographs of he and Frank, you know, hanging out. But it was odd. It was an interesting and very cool upbringing. Again, I didn't really see the darker side to things, or didn't even suspect that it existed until I got older.
Do you feel as if that growing up in that climate allowed you to be able to understand the business a little bit more, or to know what was ahead of you as you proceeded into it? So you kind of had some fair warning in terms of what to expect, or do you think it was more of a hindrance? But I would imagine it would be something that would have helped your career overall, the fact that your parents were in it and you were sort of steeped in it as a kid.
I think you're correct. I think that it did help me in many respects. Helped me to realize that it wasn't all going to be, you know, roses and honey or whatever it is, and milk and honey and some roses, and vials of roses.
Black tar heroin.
Uh, whatever. Yeah, Black Tar Heroin. And it definitely helped me cope with the inevitable rejection that comes with being in this business. And that's also comprises you get rejected a lot is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And so knowing that, that world existed and definitely helped prepare me in some way. I wasn't a hayseed when I started working.
Well, you know what they say. I mean, like for example, ball players who end up hitting a lot of home runs. Like Babe Ruth hit a ton of home runs. I don't have no idea how many home runs he hit. But the stat that I heard is that nobody struck out more often than Babe Ruth. So,
right.
Given the number of gigs you've had throughout your career, so, I mean, starting in the third grade. There had to have been a lot of rejections in there too. And, has it always been, a painful process knowing that you were kind of prepared for it, at least a little bit more than others? Or, is it something that you were able to somehow take in stride? You seem like you're a centered guy, although I don't know for sure.
I mean, I was able to take it in stride. For some reason I was really, I rarely was affected by a rejection on the part of a casting director or any project I went up for. There are some that I wish I did get that I didn't. But in retrospect, I mean, I'm going to be 58 this year, and I'll have been doing this over 30 years. I see now that for a variety of reasons, I didn't take myself as seriously as an actor as I should have. And I don't mean to imply that I would have taken the rejections harder, but I think I probably would have tried harder, made more of an effort to get certain roles, and therefore maybe I would have gotten them. Maybe I would have gone on a different path had I taken myself more seriously as an artist. Like I alluded to before, I was a little bit of embarrassment when it came to. Referring to myself, or even being in the spotlight, and yet the spotlight was coming to me. You know, I was again working in my field of choice and doing relatively well. But I also worked to reject it at the same time. And I guess what I'm saying is that the fact that I was able to deal with rejection so much, maybe that was an indication that I was afraid to kind of truly involve myself in what it took to be, you know, not just successful financially, but successful as an artist, you know, as an actor. It takes a lot of effort. Although of our favorite actors, I mean, I was just watching the movie The Favorite. Do you see that movie?
Not yet. I hear it's amazing, though.
It's incredible, you know, and as actors go, they clearly demonstrate the thing that I was just describing that I lacked. You know, they're taking it, you know, or Christian Bale or Denzel Washington. These actors go so deep that they're not afraid to be disliked. They're not afraid to not tend to their, you know, domestic chores or just be liked. You know, I spent so much of my acting career trying to get people to like me. And I'm going all over the place, but that's another reason why I eventually got off Twitter for a while, because I thought, what the fuck am I doing, man? I'm angering people.
It seems like it would be Yeah, but I mean, it seems like it would be the opposite of what you're saying about like Christian Bale and others. It seems like the more ensconced in it you might be, it seems like the stakes would then become higher in your head, thus making you, you know, more nervous or edgy on an audition and less present for those instances. It seems like a toss-up. It seems to me as if it really comes down to more about just how you're wired as a human being, whether if you're in acting, it's going on auditions and being able to wrap your head around that, or just going on a basic job interview without, you know, doing pratfalls in the middle of it accidentally and setting the guy's office on fire or something, you know?
Yeah, no, you might be right, you know. There's a balance that needs to be struck, I suppose. And I think for me personally, it was a little imbalanced. You know, like I say, I worried too much about getting the crew to like me when instead I should just concentrate on my work. You know, maybe I would have done better. But look, I'm really not complaining. I love my career. You know, I'm working well past my expiration date, and I'm looking forward to more. My plan is to go back east and do more theater and concentrate on that. And get back to that part of my myself.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not blowing smoke here, but I do believe that there is still, like, you know, an Academy Awards worthy role in your future. I still think that this is something that you can absolutely achieve, and it's just a matter of time and getting that role and sticking your face into it and really delivering. And that's one of the things that I'm absolutely confident that you'll be able to do. But I mean, I know a lot of actors and performers, a lot of voice people too. Is there a particular process that you use, a particular technique for absorbing yourself into a role and being present in that shell? I know a lot of people use the Meisner technique and so on. Is there a particular school of thought that you're into when it comes to developing your craft, so to speak?
Well, again, spoken about it yet. I'm basically using the kind of Actor's Studio Stanislavski-based training that incorporates aspects of Meisner and Stella Adler, and it has to do with emotional memory and emotional recall with a combination of using, you know, external techniques and you know, not everything is living the character. And of course, depending on the you know, the size of the role, I guess I use different approaches. You know, there are some that are sort of simpler, that all I have to do is kind of be jaunty or smart ass, and that works. But there are others. I did a play a few years ago at the Williamstown Theater Festival called Three Hotels by John Robert Bates, and that's a two-person play, and it was me and Maura Tierney, and I played an executive, the Nestle company in the 60s, which was embroiled in a lot of controversy because Nestle at the time was making baby formula, and they were diluting the baby formula, and you know, in third world countries, kids were dying, et cetera, et cetera. And my character was a guy that was kind of involved in it and was having a crisis of conscience. Well, it just, this was not something that I could just memorize the lines and walk out on stage, you know, and say. I had to really research the character, research the era, and personalize it, and also research myself, in a sense, and, you know, place myself in this person's shoes. In many ways, it's a loosely described combination of a bunch of techniques. When I went to theater school at SUNY Purchase, State University of New York at Purchase, which is a great theater department, I had a mentor by the name of Joan Potter, and she was in the first company at the Actor's Studio in the 40s. And so she really instilled in all of us actors in her company the basis of a technique. And so, like I say, I pick and choose from a variety of techniques, and then just know my own triggers and have my own reservoir of techniques and memories and things that I use and that hopefully are appropriate.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I think you're well known for, in certain circles at least, certainly people who watched Wings, is your ability to do physical comedy. Is that something that you've always kind of aspired to, or is that something that just happened accidentally based on the role of Brian Hackett?
I pretty much aspired to it. I always had an affinity for it, and I always loved watching comedy. My favorites are Laurel and Hardy. In fact, another great movie is Stan and Ollie. Beautifully done. You know, Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly do an amazing job, not only of creating and recreating famous bits and looking like them, they also are able to render them in ways that aren't that kind of, hagiographic or hagiographic, where they, they're not, you know what I mean? Where it's not like Lincoln walking around saying, I need to have dinner at 4:07.
That's right. It's not.
The government said, Mary, get me the fucking, I'm hungry, please. You know, and so that's what
you know what? You're so right. You know your history because Lincoln actually said that. I've seen that on some memes recently. Mary, I need my fucking book. Where are the fucking pictures I was supposed to see?
That's right. This hard tack stinks, Mary.
You know, I combined Abe Lincoln with a tape that I have of Casey Kasem going batshit during one of his records. Where this is Don on the phone? All right, I want a concerted effort not to come up to an upbeat record, and I got to talk about a dog dying.
Talk about a dog dying.
That's perfect.
Good golly, Miss Molly.
So what the hell are we talking? We're talking about physical acting,
actor,
right?
Technique.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so that, of course, leads us to the topic of Wings, of course. It's a spinoff of one of the most successful shows ever, Cheers. I mean, was there a lot of pressure on you and Tim and Crystal and Thomas to live up to the Cheers standard? Was there, like, pressure to be, like, the new Ted Danson and Kelsey Grammer, like you and Tim, or have all this, like, the entire network's bearing down, and you're carrying the mantle now, Weber. You better make it good.
Simply stated, no.
Oh, thank God.
There was no pressure. It was definitely, it was one of the it was a situation where the producers of Wings had just come off of Cheers and another show, Dear John, and a bunch of Taxi. You know, a lot of shows, and so there was not so much pressure as much of a luxury. We were given this time slot and with these redoubtable show creators and we just went over time. Luckily we were given more seasons. We ended up running almost
170 episodes, something like that.
And we were able to kind of evolve and develop, but there was no real pressure. I was a younger guy. This was part of where I was. This was almost a lark. I was going in this direction. What the hell? You know, it seemed to be happening of itself, and I was on for the ride, so I didn't feel pressured.
Yeah, I mean, even at the time, there was cable television certainly existed, but it wasn't the renaissance that we're engaged in now, where there are literally a gazillion shows. So it would seem to me as if, I mean, it's interesting that you were so centered going into it, because I mean, at the time there was three networks and Fox, and you were smack in the middle of this powerhouse lineup, this murderer's row on NBC. And it you know, I guess it says a lot about, you know, your preparation and your background that you were able to approach that in a very centered and cohesive way psychologically.
But I tell you, like, even as an actor, I decided early on that I wasn't going to be afraid or nervous or have stage fright or any of that stuff.
How do you decide to not be nervous? It seems like it's something that you either are or you're not. How do you do that? How do you figure that out?
I don't know. You know, I just felt like it was almost assumed that we had to have stage fright, and I did. And I thought, no, this is getting in my way. It's getting in my way, and I can't allow it.
Yeah.
And so, it came out in other ways. I mean, it didn't manifest in like shaking or forgetting lines, which was happening to me. But later on, once I made the decision, it kind of how did it? I mean, I would lose sleep, surely. It sounds like I'm making a joke, but I did the producers in New York. I took over from Matthew Broderick in 2002 on Broadway and did the production of the producers for about 10 months. And I was so not nervous, but I could not take a decent crap for weeks. Okay. And I realized that, redistributed my anxiety into my bowels. So my hands were perfectly steady and I was, you know, ready to sing and dance. But for the life of me, I did not have a decent bowel movement.
Oh, my God. See, I've heard of people doing that when they go on vacation and they have to stay in a hotel or something like that. And they don't shit for like the whole full extent of the vacation. But you, I mean, right. You 172 episodes of Wings and Steven Weber suddenly getting larger on set as he
refuses to shit. Horrible, like a farting in the middle of a monologue. And, people laughing. Thank God it was a comedy. So, it was fine. It was disguised.
I mean, how completely consuming was it to be in the midst of a run like that? I mean, that was a massively successful show. Like I said, 170, 172 episodes, half hour each. I mean, the old school sitcom shooting schedule. Did it feel like at any point that you were just underwater and you needed some escape from that? Or was it just you were just letting it wash over you?
Well, in fact, when you started the sentence, I thought you were talking about the producers and theater and Broadway, because that's literally, that is all consuming.
Yes.
You don't have any time except one day off, and your days are never free, and it's really, you know, very difficult. For Wings and the sitcom world, that is the complete opposite. It is a joy. It's the schedule that every TV actor aspires to. Mm-hmm. It is very luxurious. I mean, this won't endear me to people who already say like, "Yeah, just be an actor and shut up." But it really is the kind of gold standard of job schedules and job experience. You show up maybe Monday 10 o'clock. And you sit around the table, and you have food, and you read the script, and then you go home. Yeah. You know, you go home at noon, and then you show up next day, same time, and you do that, and then eventually you shoot. And then you begin to rehearse. It's actually, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's incredibly luxurious. It's very, It's like the Mar-a-Lago of jobs. Like, show up,
Jesus!
You go to a gold toilet.
I mean, with that number of
Russian
episodes,
operatives all over the place.
I mean, are you ever flipping through the channels? Knowing, I don't know whether or not people even still flip through channels. If you're, are you ever flipping through channels and you land on a Wings episode? And you go, I have no recollection whatsoever of that particular episode. What the hell?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, man. I mean, because you know, I've worked a decent amount, and it all gets lost. It's like an old Rolodex. I mean, I can't remember certain things. But there are, on the other hand, a lot of things that do stand out from those days. But they were glorious days in many respects. And like I say, that job is the job that's most coveted by TV actors. They have the best schedule.
Yeah.
Invariably, they're paid very well. And if a show goes on, you know, like I'm good friends with Eric McCormick, and this motherfucker is in the second incarnation of Will and Grace, you know? And he's a guy that doesn't take it for granted still after all this time. He cannot believe that he hit the jackpot twice. I'm going to kick his ass later.
Well, I mean, has Peter Casey and the guys opened discussions with you and Tim about a reboot of Wings following suit?
No. You know, the thing about Wings is that even at the time, it was while it was a successful show, I always refer to it as a utility show in that it was kind of like the joint that held that part of the infrastructure together, because we were never sexy like Cheers or Friends or outrageous like Seinfeld. You name it, you know. We were a relatively wholesome show. I mean, it was legitimately funny. And looking at old episodes now, especially the later ones where we hit our stride, like after the third season.
Yeah, after Tony comes on, Tony Shalhoub
is
on. Yeah, yeah.
What's that?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, to me, Wings really hits its stride, I think, once Tony came on the show, once Tony Shalhoub was in there. There's like a missing piece of the puzzle, and then suddenly Tony Shalhoub is in there, and you're like, oh, this is fantastic.
No, we had a great ensemble, and everybody was, I thought, was really gifted, and people liked it. And, you know, as unsexy as, let's say, the show was, it was never corny, oddly enough. But to your question, I don't think there will be a Wings reboot. I'm available. I think Tim's firmly ensconced in his show, Madam Secretary.
Oh, right, and, yep.
He's firmly ensconced with Taio Leone as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he would come back to do show, but who the hell knows? I mean, we're too fucking old already, you know. I mean, and actually, my pitch would be to do a reboot of Wings, but make it dark and very, you know, Stranger Things, Netflixy, weird.
That'd be gross. So it'd be the post 9/11 version of Wings.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, let's not try to redo the characters.
Yeah.
You know, Brian has long hair, and he's like a zany womanizer, and Joe's uptight. No, make it real,
right.
The real thing. It'd be like, yee. It's like there's been some guy on some website who made anatomically correct and very, very real-like sculptures, real-life sculptures of cartoon characters. Like there's one of Homer Simpson.
Oh, yeah.
One of... you know, and they're terrifying. That's what I'd like to do with Wings.
They
make
are
it real.
Absolutely horrifying. And yeah, to do like some sort of thing like where you combine 24 and Wings. And suddenly,
yeah, of course.
Stephen Weber and Tim Daly defuse a bomb this week on Wings. And
inside Faye. You know, it's like the bomb has been lodged inside Faye.
I mean, is there a marked difference between the way TV was... This, I think I'm answering my own question by asking this, but is there a difference between the way TV was made when you were doing Wings versus TV that's being made now? Again, going back to this huge saturation, almost this golden age of television that we're in right now, where there are shows everywhere, there's lots of work to be had, but I mean, the actual process as a working actor, has that changed at all, or is it basically the same crab, just in a modern context?
I think it's the latter, to a certain extent. I think that, you know, people still do the same jobs in the same ways,
mm-hmm.
but I think that the way shows are constructed and aired has changed a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to look at, maybe not hard, but it's interesting to look at some older shows. The scenes, for one thing, are longer.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are shows like I used to watch How I Met Your Mother, and you know, those are all, they're almost like little blackouts. Same with like Big Bang Theory, something like that. These are all, you know, excellent shows, but the way they are constructed has changed, I think, probably as a result of people's attention spans.
Yeah.
And that's the only, you know, I think that's an attempt to kind of match the attention span. I have always held that if you just, you don't have to do that to engage somebody. In a way, the so-called old-fashioned way of doing things really works. And that's, look, that's already been proven on cable. You know, those cable shows are extraordinary and have done what, in many ways, what feature films have stopped doing. They are engaging. They tell long-form stories. And that's, people love, you know, they're not just always reduced to that kind of Twitter mentality or, you know, watching things on their phones, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of it has changed in some ways, again, the process itself hasn't.
Mm-hmm. And I know, obviously, this has got to be a question that you field quite often, but the whole reboot question. So, of course, that would lead us to, you know, Sorkin is looking at a West Wing reboot. I mean, has there been...
Yeah.
Has there been any talk, and I'm crossing my fingers when I'm asking this, has there been any talk of revisiting Studio 60, which, as far as I'm concerned, died long, long, long before its time?
Yeah.
It's just a brilliant
show.
No,
there has been no mention of it. I mean, that was I think, a difficult time for Aaron.
Yeah.
Creatively, I think people had their knives out for him after his astronomic success with West Wing.
Mm.
So it's no surprise that people would be thinking of doing West Wing again.
Yeah.
I don't know why they would think, oh, let's do the show that caused everybody to, you know, fucking hemorrhages. Let's do that again. You know, it definitely did die before its time. There was so much good about it, and the Kinks, I think, could have been worked out in many ways.
Well, it seems to me
there's been no talk about
it. I mean, the death of that show, though, it seems to me as if it had to do, and of course, coming from the outside, I'm not privy to anything that happened on the inside, but it seemed to me as if it was the writer's strike, ultimately, that killed Studio 60, which is, to me, an unnatural. It was like the show was assassinated. It wasn't canceled. It didn't die. It was just it was lost based on outside circumstances that were completely out of the control of all of you. Is that an accurate read, or is this more along the lines of something that was just not settling internally?
Well, I think that was I think what you described was an element that went into its demise. I think ultimately it had to do with money.
Yeah.
It was a very expensive show to shoot. The actors themselves were not making huge salaries by any stretch. You know, guys like Brad Whitford and Matthew Perry were not making their old salaries. They were just working they were just happy to be on the show, really, as mm-hmm. we all were. Eventually, though, it was such a big show that every shot was costing a lot of money. That was one, I think, one aspect. And another aspect was that, I think the show itself was a little problematic, you know, as it was being created, almost on the fly. I think, but what I wanted to say was that. It encountered so much flack. I felt like the critics were as though they were standing around a woman who was ready to give birth, just kind of, you know, wringing their hands, waiting. Oh, I can't wait for this baby to come out. I'm going to make fun of it. And sure enough, the baby was born. And they said, well, why isn't it walking? Why isn't it talking? What's the matter? Is it stupid? What's it? It's not coordinated. In other words, it was Jesus. Not given a chance to really get on its feet and do what we all felt it could have done. There were some moments of real brilliance there in that show. It's hard to say what goes into the success or failure of a show. I'm sure there's a huge financial element because that seems to be what it's all about. There are exceptions to that rule. Obviously, you know, an exception comes when a guy like Larry David will stand in a parking lot and NBC and scream at executives who want to take it off the air, you know,
right.
And scream at them until they leave it on. But, I don't know. It's hard to say, you know, I'm just a bit of a foot soldier.
Yeah.
And I just kind of show up when they tell me to show up and I punch out at the end of the day.
There's a thing in this country. And again, not to get too overly critical of our home nation here, but the fact is that we like to build up heroes in this country. And then as soon as we get them to that pinnacle, we like to crush them. And that happens time and time again. It seems to me as if, based on what you're saying, same thing happened to Aaron Sorkin with Studio 60, where it's more along the lines of, well, we dare you to make something as good as West Wing. You're good luck. And, you know, everyone stands back with their arms folded. And then, of course, in that kind of climate, you're almost doomed to fail before minute one of the pilot. And
that's it.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes its own story that people then want to follow. It's really crappy. You know, it's very dispiriting
mm-hmm.
somehow.
Very much so. And especially for you. I mean, I always saw your character. You were the head of the studio, or the head of the network.
Yeah.
Jack Rudolph was your character.
Yeah.
And you were basically the Martin Sheen. You were the Jed Bartlett of Studio 60. I mean, knowing that, going in, you guys must have been riding just the crest of a wave. And then when it crashed down, that must have been devastating. I mean, how did you handle it when it, you know, you got to that point and say, well, we can't do a season. We're not picking you up for season two. Was that devastating? It had to have been.
Well, I think devastating, again, given my propensity to not be affected by rejection. I mean, I wouldn't say it was devastating. It was definitely disappointing. You know, look, we were somewhat aware of the shaky ground that we were on almost the whole time.
I mean, it's
this weird duality. You're fated by the network. You're celebrated, you know, and there are billboards and everything. And at the same time, people are tearing you apart, you know? And I guess made the mistake of reading a lot of that stuff. I was really curious about it and curious about why it was happening. As for my character being the Jed Bartlett type, I mean, I don't know if he started out that way. I mean,
Well, I mean, Jed Bartlett didn't start out as being the centerpiece of the West Wing until episode two. I mean, it wasn't he was only intended to do like a almost a glorified cameo on that show.
Oh, and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, I you know, the thing about the character that I played was that he was kind of on the outer ring, you know, a little bit on the periphery. And in a sense, I think that's what made that whole storyline, including my character and the other characters in that world, more successful, perhaps, or accessible than the core group of characters, you know. And that was Amanda Peet and Sarah Paulson and Matt Perry and Brad Whitford. It's almost like we were told immediately, the audience was told, these guys are great, they're hilarious, they're in love, you have to love them. And that was I think a difficult thing for people to accept. We hadn't grown on the audience yet, and that's why I think at least another season we would have found more of an audience, and we would have found more of our rhythm. We kind of went in bulling. We went in like a bull, and you know, kind of coming off the West Wing and coming off of Aaron's, you know, amazing trajectory and energy and promise that this was going to be West Wing, but for TV, you know. And right away, people were saying, "No, no, no, asshole! It's not life or death. It's not geopolitics. It's fucking TV." You
know? That's right.
And so, well, you know, and it was hard to, and they were right in a sense. You know, we needed to kind of relax a little bit. And the thing about my character and the storyline was that it wasn't the main focus of the writers.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of written with a little more lightness, a little more deftness in a way. It was simpler, and I think that had a very good effect. People liked it, and it was certainly great to play. I was disappointed that I didn't get another chance, more time to play that character, for sure.
Well, it seems to me the only thing that I could kind of see from a creative point of view on that show was that, say, for example, in the first four seasons of The West Wing, you never really saw Jed Bartlett or any of the characters how the public saw them. You never saw Jed Bartlett delivering a State of the Union address in the first four seasons that Sorkin was on. And with Studio 60, I thought where you would kind of dial down your interest in an episode is when they actually showed the sketches that the characters on the show were producing. And when you build up these characters as being these comedy geniuses, you kind of have to deliver on the actual comedy that they're creating too. And I felt like maybe the HMS Pinafore thing was a Sorkinism for sure, but maybe this wasn't the best idea for the first sketch that we actually see.
Well, yeah,
you know, maybe. Look, I don't know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. While I appreciated it, that particular sketch, because I, you know, I'm a theater nerd, that was great for me.
Oh, sure.
It didn't have its, you know, it didn't have its finger on the pulse of what, you know, what we were assuming, that this was an SNL-like show. And almost too late, some changes were made, you know, where there was an attempt to address that particular aspect. But by that time, the momentum had been lost.
Yeah.
And fate of the show was becoming clear. In my opinion, D.L. Hughley was not used to his maximum effectiveness.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, you're right about that.
He's a fucking genius, this guy, you know, and really good actor. We had a lot of fun working together. And I thought, just let him do his thing, you know, let that guy, he knows what to do, you know. And they had Mark McKinney from Boys in the Hall, Kids in the Hall, and he was on, and he was an actor, but he also wrote a little bit. But again, by that time, it's like, it was such a big event, a big phenomena, a big experience, that show, that when it died, it was almost like top heavy. It just never really got going. For so many reasons.
It's such a shame.
It was good to be a part of it. God, you know, it was fantastic.
Well, I mean, I always see it as one of those things like Freaks and Geeks that was just died right. too soon before it found its audience, yeah. before it hit its stride. I mean, it was, well, Freaks and Geeks, you could argue that, you know, it was this one self-contained season and it works in that sense. But it just, you always are left wanting more from these. You want to see what happened to these characters going forward. And in that sense, it was a real shame to see it go away prematurely like that. And for circumstances that did involve things that had little to do or nothing to do, in fact, with how the show was being created and how it was being run. But
one of the things that's hardest to be hardest to stomach in the creative area is that you have to fail. You've got to fuck up, you know, and in order to, that's why shows try out of town, you know, and that's what they're doing, you know, and basically what you're seeing on TV is you're seeing early rehearsals, you know, and it's being put up on the air and then judged. And then, you know, things take time. Things take time to develop. Anyway, I keep cutting you off.
No. God damn it. It's about you. It's all about you, Steven Weber.
So, I love you. I love you.
Along those lines, how does it feel to have been Stephen King's preferred Jack Torrance?
another controversial.
I got to tell you, such an utterly ballsy choice. And I kind of group that before you get to your response. I kind of group that with taking over for Matthew Broderick on the producers. You have the cojones to step in after these iconic performances, and you really made it your own. I mean, I know a lot of people who just adore that remake, that three episode miniseries of The Shining, with you as Jack Torrance, mainly because it really, in addition to your performance, it really nailed the book, which I guess made Stephen King happy, right?
That was the whole point of its being produced. As most or a lot of people know, you know, Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick did not get along. Kubrick, however brilliant that film was, and of course it is, kind of bowdlerized Stephen King's novel. Stephen King, you know, naturally wasn't happy about that, and they kind of parted ways. This was a chance. The ABC miniseries was a chance to make a show that was more faithful to the story, and the legions of King fans were grateful for it. I think as a version of the show, of the story rather, it hit a lot of great notes. I personally, for myself, I would love to redo that because there were some aspects of the character and the world that I didn't fully understand, grasp. You know, that basically it's not a monster movie; it's a story about alcoholism, you know, and its effect on the family, you know, effect on the mind, and so now being a middle-aged man who's been through some shit, now I get it. You know, now I could go back and understand and maybe do it a little better. But yeah, it definitely has its pros. It definitely, you know, we were in the early part of CGI territory. So when the famous hedge monsters come alive, compared to what they can do today, it looks like, you know, sock puppetry. and not clean socks.
But yeah.
Anyway. And, but, you know, there's some things that work and things that didn't. As for ascribing cojones to me, again, it had to do, I didn't think it through, man. If I had taken myself more seriously, maybe I wouldn't have done it. But I had an opportunity to audition, and I nailed the audition, and we did it, you know, and that's that.
Yeah, was there, like, this thought in the back? And I imagine, based on what you've said already, that, you know, Jack Nicholson wasn't haunting you in the back of the head, going, oh, my God, I got to live up to what, you know, what Jack did. And was there an element of that? Like, you know, I got to make this different than what Jack was doing, or was that the mandate from the outset?
It only came up when there were certain set pieces in both the novel, the Kubrick movie, and the miniseries.
The crossovers,
yeah. And the most noticeable one is, of course, Here's Johnny. Mm-hmm. And we actually got to that part where Rebecca De Mornay is cowering behind a door, and the bathroom door, and I've got to smash it through, not with an axe, but with a croquet mallet, which is faithful to the story. And we I remember on the day we all looked at each other and we said, oh shit, this is something that a lot of people are going to focus on. what do we do? And we came up with something that we thought, and I don't really know how effective it was, but we thought that would be kind of the kind of creative, I don't know what you call it, not the antithesis, but something that would be the opposite. So instead of saying, here's Johnny, we came up with, I smash a hole in the door, put my face through it, and just go, boo. Okay. You know, so that's what we did. Yeah, I think we tried a couple of different other things, pithy lines. But at that point, it becomes so iconic that I think the quicker we go past it, the better. I was not burdened by thoughts of Jack Nicholson. Yep. The fact was that the script itself and the story was ultimately very different from the Kubrick film. There was more text, more layers, more nuance, more humanity in the characters than what you see in Kubrick's Shining. You know, however brilliant he is, Nicholson, one of the criticisms is that, you know, he's menacing from the get-go. Yeah. Or he's crazy from the get-go. And one thing we tried to do was show a normal family before they are gripped by demons, both interior and exterior.
Yeah, it was one of the major differences between the film and the miniseries is that you were able to develop that character and you know, allow us to follow along with that descent into, you know, alcohol withdrawal based right. madness, which is really the, as you said, was really the subtext of the piece. And so I think that's what made it one of the many things that made it its own thing, separate from what Kubrick did with the material. I think you put your own stamp on it, too. And I think that was one of the reasons why so many people, I believe, respond to it. There, at this point, first of all, I got to say, we're now at an hour 15. If you have to bail,
yeah, that's
totally fine. Are you done? Are you ready to strangle me with your feet?
I've always been ready to strangle you with my feet. This is just another reminder that you need to be strangled with feet.
I know. Everyone tells that to me.
Everyone tells you that.
Every single show. It's like, Bob, I'm ready to strangle you with my feet. And I go, well, yeah, understandable. Everyone says that to me. I wanted to ask you a couple of last questions here. Is there, and this, I guess it would be a two-part question. Is there a role, and I think you mentioned this early on, is there a role that was the one that got away that you wish you had done or you got rejected for, and that it was just one of those things you said, this is going to make my career. Likewise, is there a role that you have played that, let's say, putting Wings aside, putting all those sort of marquee projects aside, is there a role that you want people to remember you by?
Gosh. Oof. That's a hard question.
Especially considering you've got a gigantic resume. So it's hard to choose from.
I've got a reasonable size resume, I guess I've aged out of certain roles that I wished I had pursued, and they're mostly theater roles. I don't mind being known as Brian from Wings. It ran a long time. It did very well for me, and people seem to like it. And he was an affable character, so I don't mind being known for that.
Is he the closest? Is Brian the closest to you? Is Brian and Steven Weber as similar as they get, or is that the role that was closest to your personality, or was there another that was kind of like,
I think it maybe was when I was a younger guy, you know, and it was exaggerated, you know, the kind of the jaunty, haha, womanizing, you know, kind of funny, dopey dude. That there was an aspect to my personality that was definitely reflected in that role, but over the years, you know, I mean. And again, as I've lived more life, things have become more complex. And so hopefully the roles that I've played are reflections of that as well. I have to say that I really did enjoy the role of Jack Rudolph in Studio 60, because here was a guy that was incredibly competent and was a company man and followed the rules, but also had a great heart. You know, mm-hmm. this was a... And again, it was something that became more apparent towards the end of the run of the show. And it wasn't anything that I suspected was there at the beginning. You know, it just sort of evolved. That's that's been a role that I really liked and enjoyed. And I suppose as opposed to having just one role to be remembered by, I always did aspire when I was a kid to be a character actor, somebody who has that kind of journeyman career. The movies that I watched as a kid and still watch now were packed with these actors, some of whose names I don't know, some of whose names people don't know, but nevertheless existed and aided and abetted the success of many great films. You know, you could look at It's a Wonderful Life and see, you know, Beulah Bondi and Henry Travis and you know all these people that weren't stars, but whose faces and whose presences lent such credibility and beauty to these movies and mm-hmm. shows. That's kind of that's what I wanted to be remembered for as a good journeyman actor who played a variety of roles. You know, not just one. Although I got to tell you, I've been essaying the role of douchebag in a suit for the last 15 years. And Getting a little tedious. we need an affable douchebag. Get Weber.
Weber, he's the quintessential affable douchebag. We'll sign him up. Yeah. You know, and I was mentioning earlier, I mean, you're doing stage, TV, film, voice work, but you're also an animated GIF. I don't know if you know this. One of my listeners, Amy Taylor, wanted me to ask you about working with Mel Brooks on Dracula, Dead and Loving It. And there's actually a GIF of you going around. It's you stabbing Dracula in the heart and a comically huge geyser of blood erupting from the wound and basically bukkakeing you right in the face with all the blood. I had to work in bukkake into this conversation, too.
I guess so. As you always do. That's your trademark.
That's my trademark.
That was fantastic working with him. Obviously, he was one of my heroes, and it led, I want to say, fairly directly to me working the producers later on. But that show was fantastic. Mm. Dracula Dead and Loving It, not the greatest movie, you know, works better on TV than in the big screen. And that particular gag is very well remembered. And in fact, a few years ago, I took my sons to the AFI tribute to Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
And it was in Hollywood, and it was incredibly starry. I went there, and, I mean, everybody was there, man. You know, De Niro was there. Morgan Freeman was there. Everybody was there. You know, Cloris Leachman, et cetera, and one after the other, they got up, and they told all these amazing stories about him, and they showed clips from his movies, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, you name it, you know. Mm-hmm. And in one of the interviews of him that were on, it was on screen, he was asked, "What is the funniest scene you've ever filmed?" and he said, "It's the scene with Steven Weber when he stakes the vampire and he gets." And I'm sitting there kind of thinking, "What?
Huh?" Awesome.
And my young son, Alfie, looks at me and goes, "Papa, that's you!" And indeed, I was in shock. And I looked around at the faces of all these, you know, every star in the Hollywood firmament was there. And they, too, had an expression like, "What?"
Well,
you know,
I mean, they
weren't shaking their heads. They were saying, "Oh, yeah, absolutely." And they were saying, "What? You mean nothing with Gene Wilder, nothing with Peter Boyle, nothing with Terry Garr, nothing with, no, this schmuck TV boy got the best one?" So that was it.
Now, did you stamp out your cigarette and go, "I'm done here. My work is finished. So long, suckers." And just did that cross your mind?
I fucking should have. If I'd done that afterwards and said, "So long, assholes," and walked out, that would have been legendary.
Yeah.
But no, I was in shock. I couldn't believe what was happening.
Well, let me ask you, what kind of dad is the Twitter scrotum guy?
What kind of dad is the Twitter scrotum guy?
Yeah, well, you've got two boys, you're the Twitter scrotum guy. So.
I love my sons. They're 16 and 18 years old.
Wow.
They're everything. They're everything to me. I'm going to start to cry. They're everything to me, period. You know, I didn't have necessarily the greatest upbringing or the greatest role models. You know, I think men need male role models to teach them shit. Mm-hmm. society is not going to teach them those values that are so necessary anymore. You know, without getting too personal, you know, I went through some heavy shit in my life, you know, in the last 10 years or so. And my boys have seen a lot of, seen me in every iteration. You know, they've seen me on the floor and they've seen me stand up. And and so I've been spending my life and intend to continue to try to be a good man for them to have in their lives, you know, and it's not easy. It's not easy to get that from society, get that from our culture, especially with men. So how am I as a father? I try to be loving. I try to be patient. I try not to get angry, which is the root of so much fucking bad behavior, you know, and try to understand that we're only here for a short time. And so I want to, you know, want to practice love and patience and compassion as much as possible.
Are your boys receptive to that? I mean, at 16 and 18, are they more like, Dad, come on?
Well, I mean, I have to temper it. You know, I mean, you know, they're constantly, you know, because it's their imperative to, you know, get me out of the way, get the silverback gorilla out of the way so they can get to mama. You know, that's it. So I realize now that, you know, I can't gush over them, but I suspect that at some point, probably after I'm flushed away, that they will, they'll appreciate it. You know, that appreciation happens way after you're there, it seems to me. And that's okay. That's the way it goes.
Well, my friend, it was such a pleasure. I can't believe it's been 10 years in which we've never actually had a phone conversation. But now that I've got your phone
number. 10 more years.
Yeah, now that I got your phone number, though, I'm going to be calling you at like 3 o'clock in the morning. Hey, Weber! Yes. I got this great idea for a tweet. It involves Bukkake and smegma. Good luck.
The number you have reached is no longer in service. Goodbye.
On that note, good luck to you, my friend. We'll see you on Twitter.
Thanks, Bob. I'll see you soon. I'll see you in 10 years, baby.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye.